From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and a federal appeals court in California has ruled that the Second Amendment does not give Americans the right to carry concealed guns in public. The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals made that ruling yesterday. It affects nine states in the West. Joining us now to discuss via Skype is Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Professor, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us more about what this panel ruled and how it fits in with the Second Amendment.
The Ninth Circuit Court ruling en banc, which means 11 judges, ruled that the Second Amendment does not guarantee a right to carry a concealed gun in public. This is a major issue because while the Supreme Court has said there is a Second Amendment right to have a gun in your home for personal protection, the court has not addressed whether you have a right to carry a gun in public. And this court said no concealed carry.
And you use the term personal protection. Personal safety is the term that I have seen on this, that played into this ruling.
Well, that's right. The argument that the gun rights advocates were making was that California's effective ban on concealed carry in its major cities put people at risk, that people could not confront dangers when they were attacked on the streets or whatnot. But the court held that there was still a very good reason for government to limit access to these guns on the streets.
And this is a case that was being reheard, right? Because the Ninth Circuit in 2014 ruled that the Second Amendment does allow some forms of carry of self-defense outside the home.
That's right. This same court ruled that you do have a right to carry a gun outside the home, and that created a split among the federal courts of appeals. Other federal courts of appeals had held there is no right to carry a gun in public, or at least upheld this kind of very restrictive concealed carry permitting. And it was important that the court struck down that earlier decision yesterday because it means there's no split in the federal courts, and the Supreme Court is less likely to take the case.
You think the Supreme Court will not take this case? Because this is obviously gun rights advocates are not going to be happy with this ruling at all.
Well, on the one hand, the Supreme Court should take this case. This is a very important open question. Do you have a right to carry a gun in public? This is a big issue, and there's cases all over the country dealing with it. The Supreme Court should step in. However, I think with eight justices, the court is really unlikely to step in because it's such a hot-button, controversial issue. They're unlikely to be able to get a five-justice majority in any direction.
So if this stands, if this ruling from the Ninth Circuit stands, what does that mean for people in California, Alaska, Arizona, Hawaii, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington?
Its biggest impact will be in places like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Diego, major cities in California that have very restrictive concealed carry policies. Those policies are now constitutionally permissible. Other states like Montana and Idaho, other states that are in that circuit, have very loose concealed carry laws, so they're not really going to be affected by this decision.
What does it mean for the states outside the Ninth Circuit? Anything?
Well, this becomes an opinion that can be used as persuasive authority in other court cases. It's not a binding precedent in other jurisdictions, but it does provide more fodder for gun control advocates to say, hey, look, this claim that restrictions on concealed carry is unconstitutional, well, look, that's been rejected by all these other courts.
Did this ruling surprise you?
This ruling was not a big surprise. Ever since the court decided to take this case en banc to rehear that 2014 decision that we mentioned earlier, everyone was sort of expecting that the court would eventually rule that restrictive concealed carry policies are constitutionally permissible.
Just for people who don't follow this as closely as you do, why is there such a dramatic difference from the court's perspective between concealed carry and open carry?
Well, I think the big difference is that many places have different kinds of restrictions on concealed carry versus open carry. And the court yesterday basically said there's no challenge here to California's ban on open carry. So we're not going to address that question directly. But if gun rights advocates want to challenge that ban on open carry, the decision said they can make that challenge and the court will consider that case when it arises.
That's Adam Winkler, a professor of constitutional law at the UCLA School of Law. He's the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
Well, there's also been a move in Congress to renew a federally funded suicide prevention program. The renewal has been written into various versions of various bills. That's not uncommon. What is uncommon is the origin of the initial legislation, a father who lost his son to suicide 13 years ago. Reporter Joanne Silberner takes a look at how this suicide prevention program got its start and where it is today.
Gordon Smith remembers every detail of a night back in September 2003. He and his wife Sharon had just returned from a trip to Georgia to their home in Maryland.
And the doorbell rang, and my wife was calling upstairs where I was unloading the luggage, and said, "There, please hurry down. There was two policemen at our door."
Before that moment, Gordon Smith had it all. He was a U.S. senator, wealthy and classically handsome, with a beautiful wife and three kids. What came next was Smith's greatest horror.
He said he had the duty to tell me that our son, Garrett Lee Smith, had taken his life in his college dorm in Utah.
Garrett had become increasingly remote. He'd had periods of depression. He'd given away his CDs and television. But neither the Smiths nor anyone around Garrett at school had realized how serious things were. After months of grieving, Gordon Smith took to the floor of the Senate. He spoke with difficulty, only occasionally glancing at his notes. C-SPAN captured it.
"Last September, Sharon and I lost our son, Garrett Lee Smith, to a long battle that he suffered from mental illness. He suffered emotional pain that I cannot begin to comprehend."
Garrett's bipolar disease was like a cancer, Smith said, and it was attacking other young people as well. Something, he said, had to be done.
"So the bill I offer today with these great colleagues, Republican and Democrat alike, is intended to help other people who suffer from mental illnesses that are so devastating that it places them at risk for taking their own lives."
The Garrett Lee Smith Act passed the Senate unanimously and was eventually signed into law. This year, states, colleges, and Indian tribes will get about $48 million. Western Washington University in Bellingham has a three-year, $295,000 program, online and classroom education for dorm RAs, students, and staff, suicide awareness walks, available counselors, and outside speakers like Kevin Hines. Hines has the same condition Garrett had, bipolar disease. He jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge 3 years before Smith died. Hines, however, beat the odds. He survived with a story for the Western Washington audience.
"The millisecond, the moment my hands left that rail and my legs went over it, I had what was called an instant regret."
In 4 seconds, he'd hit the water.
"The realization at that moment that I had just made the single worst mistake of my entire life, and that, to my knowledge, it was too late. That I was 19 and I was going to die."
Improbably, he was among the 1-2% of jumpers who've survived. After the talk, student Hannah Voss, who had once contemplated suicide herself, said she felt supported.
"That was so incredibly moving and, like, resonated so well with what I've been through."
It was therapeutic, she says, especially Hines's warning that recovery from mental illness is a process that has to be worked at, with formal therapy when appropriate, with reaching out to others.
"Knowing that there's somebody else out there who's experienced that kind of desperation and feeling that I have is also really, really helpful."
Richard McKeon of the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration says there's evidence that programs like these work. He points to data comparing counties with the Garrett Lee Smith Act program to counties without.
During the period that the study covered, which is 2007 to 2010, there were about 427 fewer deaths by suicide because of the Garrett Lee Smith Memorial Act.
And for the same period, there were 79,000 fewer attempts among young people. But McKeon notes that the impact drops off after the program ends. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recently reported that the national suicide rate among 15 to 24-year-olds is going up. McKeon believes the numbers would have gone up more without the act. He credits Gordon Smith's speech back in 2004.
"I have no doubt that from the tragedy of his own loss and the incredible champion that Gordon Smith became, that he has saved young lives."
Today, the act itself has bipartisan support in Congress. It's included in two mental health reform bills. If all goes as hoped, and if Congress gets through its schedule, the act is likely to be renewed. As for Gordon Smith, he still gets letters from parents whose children have been helped by the programs. And he's thankful for the tragedies that have been avoided. The loss of college students like his son, non-students, Native Americans, young lives that would otherwise have been lost.
And that's how Garrett still lives and has meaning in, from his life, even today.
For Here and Now, I'm Joanne Silberner.
Today, millions around the world are remembering Muhammad Ali. There's a day-long service that he planned for his hometown of Louisville, Kentucky. We've been remembering Ali all week. Our stories are at hereandnow.org. Today, Ali the poet. One-liners he used to taunt opponents with. I'm so frightening, I hit like lightning. Then the long form. Here he is in Ireland in 1972, reciting part of the poem he wrote about the 1971 Attica prison uprising. In it, he imagines himself as a black inmate responding to a white warden.
Better far our fight to wage now while our blood boils with rage, lest it cool with ancient age. Better violent for us to die than to give up an Uncle Tom and try. Make him peace just to live a lie. Better if we say our sooth. We gonna die today demanding truth while we're still akin to youth.
Let's talk about Muhammad Ali through the lens of poetry with two great poets. Sonia Sanchez, former professor of English and Women's Studies at Temple University, a prominent writer in the Black Arts Movement, which burst out of the Black Power Movement in the 1960s. She joins us from WHYY in Philadelphia. Sonia, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It's good being here.
Also joining us, Adrian Mateka, poet in residence at Indiana University, and one of his books, Big Smoke, an anthology of poems about Jack Johnson. This was the very first African-American world heavyweight boxing champion from 1908 to 1915, Jim Crow America. Welcome, Adrian.
So good to be here, Robin. Thank you.
And I'm going to start with Sonia. You knew Muhammad Ali. After he became a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War, you traveled with him and read poetry together?
Yeah, people forget that when he took that position that he took, there was an uproar. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I did as a poet is that we had a huge poetry reading together at the Dome in New Orleans. Can you imagine that
no.
place? Yeah.
I wish to be a fly on that wall.
Yeah, and I wish I had the tapes of that also, too. Mm-hmm. I'm putting that out there. And what that was about was for me to present him to this huge crowd there and for me to read some poetry and for him to read some poetry also, too. And the people just loved him so very much. And it was such an honor, being with him, traveling up to the farm, to his camp where he worked out. You know, I have twin sons, and he'd get in the ring and tell them, okay, come on, beat me up. Mm-hmm. And they would, these are like 2.5-year-olds. They'd go in and bang him. And then he'd fall out, and then they'd step on him and say, we won. This is the motion and beauty and poetry of this man, the poetry of his body as he fought, but the poetry of his humanity as he dealt with us and made us all understand what it meant to be human. And when I think of him, I think of John 14:27, which says, let not your hearts be troubled, neither let them be afraid. Mm-hmm. And that's what his heart was, never afraid. He was never afraid of anything. That's why we loved him so very much.
Well, and not afraid to speak. And Adrian, it's so hard to remember that this was in a segregated America when blacks were still being lynched, and brash doesn't even come close. How do you hear his words?
Well, you know, I heard them and continue to hear them as this great example of how to create your own identity. It's signifying, it's braggadocio, but when he would say something like, you know, this kid's got a left, this kid's got a right, if he hits you once, you're out for the night. Like, that kind of thing is just unbelievable to me in terms of owning the space around you and owning your own image.
Well, let's listen to a little from the Jack Parr Show in 1964. This is before the Sonny Liston heavyweight championship fight.
This brash young boxer is something to see, and the heavyweight championship is his destiny. This kid fights great. He's got speed and endurance. But if you sign to fight him, increase your insurance.
So was this the beginning of rap?
I don't know if it was the beginning, but it has all the best parts of rap. And that's Liberace playing piano behind
too much.
Him, too,
that's
if
right.
I'm not mistaken.
That's so, right. Yeah, isn't that
you know,
amazing?
I mean, to think that this beautiful man from Louisville, getting ready to fight one of the most frightening boxers of that time. Everybody was scared of Sonny Liston. And he's on the Jack Parr show with Liberace. I mean, what kind of, you know, what kind of charisma would it take? I mean, I can't imagine a show that, or, you know, any place that might be more homogenous than daytime television in the 60s.
I just want to add to that, because he was part of a tradition, when you teach poetry and study poetry, he was part of a tradition from the past poetry, you know, like the toast. And
The toast?
They're like two lines, and they rhyme. And usually it's always done amongst men, because it's going to end up being a little dirty in some kind of way also, too, you know. But it's like the shine poems and the signifying monkey kinds of things, right? But because of his kind of dark humor and sometimes profanity. So he's a griot. He is part of that tradition from the past, but also he's part of a future tradition, which is going to come up as rap. And that is the joy that we understand. And that is why we've always been entrenched, black folks, in poetry, you know, in rhyme and cadence, you know, coming out of the church, coming out of the bars, coming out of the toasts and the signifying pieces, so it's there. So people heard it, understood it, and they responded.
Here he is in 1974, before the rumble in the jungle.
I said, last night I had a dream. When I got to Africa, I had one hell of a rumble. I had to beat Tarzan's behind first for claiming to be the king in the jungle. For this fight, I've wrestled with alligators. I've tussled with a whale. I done handcuffed lightning and put thunder in jail.
Because he said, you know, I'm bad. Just last week, I murdered a rock, injured a stone, hospitalized a brick. I'm so mean, I make medicine sick.
You know this. You know it. We're laughing, we're loving, but it's so sad to think that this kid barely graduated high school. He had a wonderful principal who thought he was going to go far in boxing, but if boxing wasn't the only avenue, you have to wonder where he might have gone.
So it's very true. The kind of awareness of the world to be able to come up with those kinds of similes and that kind of figurative language about
yourself.
And
rhyming skills, you know?
They rhyme. Yeah. I mean, just over and over. I mean, these incredible rhymes. I can't think of the exact line, but it's from that Jack Parr. And he said something like, here I predict Mr. Liston's dismemberment. I'll hit him so hard he'll wonder where October and November went. That kind of off rhyme, that's where it starts intersecting with rap to me. I mean, that great to rhyme dismemberment and October and November went. There are a lot of poets running around right now wishing they had those kind of rhyme skills.
And Sonia, we were saying he also inspired poets.
I did discover a couple of haiku that I had done, you know, but two of them that I had done, I wrote, in your love for us, you abandon mirrors. Because people would think that this man was always looking in mirrors, you know, always trying to look for his reflection. But the reflection he always looked for was coming from people, if you understood what I said, you know. Then today, waiting inside, I just wrote, I taste the rich corners of your words, you know. There were only two boxers I ever watched. My father was a great boxing fan. That was Sugar Ray Robinson. Because he had style, right? And his boxing, like Muhammad, Brother Ali's, was poetic. Mm-hmm. You know, they would give you what I call a refrain of punches. And then the knockout rhyme is the knockout punch, if you know what I'm saying. But they both line up with the precision of a poem, right? And they both had the style and beauty of a poem also, too. So I would only watch Muhammad Ali, but I haven't watched a boxing match since he stopped boxing. Because none of them had the beauty and precision as Sugar Ray Robinson and Brother Muhammad
Ali.
Well,
it's also hard to watch them because we know what they do. Adrian, just, you know, you had, as we said, written the book on Jack Johnson. You said Ali was somewhat of a verbal descendant.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you know, Jack Johnson was a great trash talker. They used to call it mouth fighting.
They used
to call it mouth fighting. And Jack Johnson was great. You watch these old clips of him, and you can see him talking. And he's got gold teeth, and he's this gorgeous man, and he's, you know, absolutely destroying his opponents and talking to them the whole time. And you can imagine that kind of behavior didn't go over so well. Talking trash operated on two levels, right? There's the level of entertainment, and then there's also that level of unsettling your opponent.
get him off balance.
And Muhammad Ali was very aware of that, that poetry is this kind of verbal sparring could be a weapon. That's smart fighting.
But, well, when he used it, though, in public, on the Jack Parr Show, it had to be done with love. Because otherwise, he wouldn't have lasted the decade.
It was, and it was done with love, but at the same time, it was rebellion, too.
Right.
Because he had to, this is a black man who's saying, this is who I am, you gotta take me for what I'm saying. My son said something, one of my twins said something, he said, Mom, you know, your generation had Brother Malcolm and Brother Martin, but my generation had Brother Muhammad Ali. And he was there. He was their personal savior. And I never thought about that. And I looked up and nodded and said, you're right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Sonia Sanchez, the poet and activist. Adrian Mateka, poet in residence at Indiana University. Thank you both so much for helping us look at Muhammad Ali through this prism.
It's an honor to talk about this man. He was the greatest.
He was the greatest.
He was the greatest.
To die fighting to be free. What more fitting end could be? Better surely than in bed, where in broken health we're led. Better that of heart attack, or some dose of drug we lack. Let us die by being black.
Muhammad Ali, again, his poem about the Attica uprising. Laid to rest today in once segregated Louisville, he'll be welcomed at a Cave Hill cemetery strewn with rose petals.
Gawker Media has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The news today comes after the company lost a lawsuit from Hulk Hogan, a.k.a. Terry Bollea, and was ordered to pay Bollea $140 million in damages. Mike Regan is a columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly. He's in New York with more on this. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So after that lawsuit, it was revealed that Peter Thiel, who co-founded PayPal, had funded the Hulk Hogan lawsuit to get revenge on Gawker, which outed him as gay back in 2007. What do you make of this filing today?
Well, I think it's sort of the only option that Gawker had left in order to keep the brand alive and to keep publishing, keep its employees employed, at least for now. Remember, when you file for bankruptcy, it doesn't mean that you've gone out of business. It basically means you don't have the money to pay your debts, and in this case, your legal settlements. And so you go to a court and you ask the court to sort out basically who gets paid what. And that's what they're doing. I mean, it's definitely not that surprising that they would have to do this.
But they will be able to stay in business, you're saying, while they sort this out.
Yeah, that's the plan. That's, you know, the main reason for filing like this.
On another big topic in business today, Puerto Rico, late yesterday, the U.S. House passed a bipartisan rescue package aimed at preventing the island's economy from collapsing. Now, Puerto Rico, as people know, is a U.S. territory. What would this package do?
Well, basically, it sets up a 7-person oversight panel to help Puerto Rico figure out how it's going to get out of this mess. And because since it's a commonwealth and not a state, it's not able to file bankruptcy like a normal state theoretically could. So the panel will be appointed by President Obama, although he'll have to pick from a list of nominees from the leaders of Congress. So the majority of the people he'll be picking from will be Republicans. And, you know, the board will basically try to – Puerto Rico and its creditors are trying to get an agreement. And if they can't reach a deal to restructure the debt themselves, then this panel would be able to guide them into a court, petition a court to basically hear what would be the equivalent of a bankruptcy case there.
And I know there had been some disagreement between the House and the Senate on what to do about Puerto Rico. Is this likely to get through the Senate as well?
There certainly will be a lot of pressure on the Senate to pass it. But with this, you know, Congress, I don't think it's a slam dunk that it will get passed right away. There's some Democratic senators, including Bob Menendez of New Jersey, who are very strongly opposed to the bill. They feel it's almost like treating Puerto Rico like a colony. And so it's possible that they could impose some hurdles that would delay its passage at the very least.
Finally, in Illinois, there has been a big fight we've covered over the budget there between the Republican governor and the Democratic legislature. But now they've got Moody's, the rating agency, downgrading the state's bond rating to 2 notches above junk status.
This really is one of the lowest credit ratings a state has had basically since 1992, when Massachusetts had a very poor credit rating. So it's not a good situation in Illinois at all.
Mike Regan, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Tony Awards are this Sunday, so everybody sing.
The $10 founding father without a father got a lot farther by working a lot harder, by being a lot smarter, by being a self-starter by 14.
And the winner is Hamilton, The End. Actually, Lin-Manuel Miranda's hip-hop retelling of the life of Alexander Hamilton set a record when it picked up 16 Tony nominations, the most ever. But there is much more to talk about, and joining us to do that from the NPR studios in New York is the New York Times chief theater critic Ben Brantley. Ben, are you feeling this way? I mean, are you meeting people coming up to you and saying, so is there anything other than Hamilton I should be thinking about at the Tonys?
The worst is people come up to me that I haven't seen since my childhood asking me if I can get them tickets to it. It's the first time I can remember that a single show has dominated the conversation as much as it has. And you start to think, well, wait a minute, are we just under mass hypnosis? Is this like, you know, Pet Rocks or Cabbage Patch Dolls? But then, you know, just listening to what you played right then, my shoulders start twitching. And every time I go back to see that show or put on the cast recording, I'm excited all over again. So in this case, it actually is worth the hype.
Yeah, it is worth the hype. And it's part of something that's happening on Broadway this season. What is that? The diversity, the something?
Well, certainly there's that, and that's a very encouraging sign. But it's been an unusually... Well, we just ran a piece with two of our women critics in the paper saying that perhaps women remain underrepresented on Broadway, which is criminal, but we've certainly seen more diversity of ethnicity than we have in many years this season.
Well, and those women, Laura Collins-Hughes and Alexis Solowski, we love that article, pointed out that the women's roles are, you know, waitresses, shop girls, revolutionary sisters, a literary editor, a morphine addict, and many victims of abuse. So, well, anyway, let's take a listen to what else is being considered. In the Best Musical category, yes, there's more than Hamilton. There's Bright Star, School of Rock the Musical, Shuffle Along, and Waitress. School of Rock composer Andrew Lloyd Webber has joked that the Sunday show should be called the Hamiltonies. But let's listen to a little of his entry with lyricist Glenn Slater. This is a little of the song Stick It to the Man.
Rant and rave and scream and shout, get all of your aggression out. They try to stop you, let them know exactly where they all can go. And do it just as loudly as you can. Stick it to the man.
That's Alex Brightman. He's also up for a Tony for his performance. Thoughts?
He's terrific, Alex Brightman. I enjoyed this show. I hadn't been a huge fan of Lord Lloyd Webber's recent work, but this had he's rejuvenated by, you know, hanging out with 10-year-olds, which is what a lot of the cast is. It's based on the Jack Black movie about a sort of maverick school teacher, or actually pretend school teacher, who leads a class of over-programmed kids to a rock competition. Everyone seems to be having such a good time doing it. In another season, it might have been a contender.
Yeah, but this is the Hamilton season. And but you also point out that there are many plays, in addition to the musicals, that have been captivating this season. The best plays include The Humans by Stephen Karam. It takes place at a Manhattan family Thanksgiving. Of course, human conflicts arise. Let's listen to this scene where the father, played by Tony nominee Reed Birney, takes his daughter, played by Sarah Steele, to task for ignoring religion while she pursues self-improvement.
You put your faith in juice cleansing and
I
yoga, but you won't try
one. My mouth is shut.
You eat chard to feel your best, but you said half your friends are in therapy. You said
that's
that, so I'm
because,
just asking.
Yeah, I was trying to get you to pay for mine. I still can't afford it.
Well, save some of the money you spend on organic juice and pay for it yourself.
The scene from The Humans, again, Tony nominee Reed Birney. We also heard a little of Tony nominee Jane Houdeshell. Your thoughts on The Humans or the other plays that, if you can't get the Hamilton ticket, you know, what rises?
And yes, people should go to the theater. It's been to see plays as well as Hamilton, because if you look at what really rakes in money at the box office, it remains mega musicals. The Humans is a lovely play. It's, I think, accessible to everyone. It's not like last year's winner, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. It's not a revolutionary play in any sense, but it's a beautifully crafted domestic drama with just a sort of slight nimbus of the supernatural, too, suggesting that the monsters that we fear in this universe are ourselves. The Humans is kind of a sci-fi title.
Now, other nominees in the plays eclipsed the father, King Charles III, which you called flat out brilliant. And I don't know if it, you know, had anything to do with it, but it's closed.
Well, it was here for a limited run.
Okay.
It was an import from London.
Well, of the nominees, what else besides The Humans would you say run to see?
Eclipsed is a really exciting play. It's women who are essentially part of a harem of a Liberian warlord and sort of the conflicts, the rivalries that develop within them. And, of course, it stars the radiant Lupita Nyong'o as one of those women who undergoes a very frightening and possibly inspiring conversion.
A couple of the things we want to point out. First of all, Audra McDonald in Shuffle Along was not nominated, after which many people had to be revived.
No, it's a crime. I mean, the problem with Audra McDonald is, I mean, she's sort of the enduring Hamilton of performance. She's so good. It's come to seem like every time she steps on a stage, she gets a Tony nomination, and the odds are that she'll win. She's the most winning of all actresses, I believe.
Well, but as you said in a conversation with your colleagues, we'll link people to that. It's great. Who would you knock out? And just let's talk about one of the other women who did get nominated, Cynthia Erivo.
Oh, she's stunning.
In
Gosh.
Color Purple.
The great thing is watching Cynthia Erivo go from this almost invisible presence into stardom. It's like watching a star grow into being before your eyes. She's the front runner for the Tony for Best Actress in a Musical, and I couldn't argue with her receiving it.
Let's listen.
Got my house, it still keep the cold out. Got my chair when my body can't hold.
Well, as we said, the Tony Awards are Sunday night. If you can't get to Broadway, watch the show because you get all of those great performances we're bound to see. And if you can't do either, the next best thing is reading about theater with Ben Brantley in the New York Times. Ben, thank you as always.
Thank you for having me.
In the film Now You See Me, a team of illusionists brought down a crooked insurance mogul through a series of public stunts. Their new adventure, Now You See Me 2, finds a star-studded cast plotting another caper. Chris Klimek has a review.
Stage magicians talk to distract us from things they don't want us to see. That's the opposite of movie exposition, where people talk through the plot so the audience won't be confused. This thriller is about magicians, but it's almost all exposition.
They robbed a bank in Paris from a stage in Las Vegas. They fleeced an insurance magnate of hundreds of millions of dollars and disappeared from a roof in New York, always showering their devoted fans with money.
This briefing from Morgan Freeman, back as a magic debunker, comes right at the start, and others follow every few scenes like mileposts on a winding highway. From Jesse Eisenberg.
How is this possible?
Woody Harrelson.
Bingo, bango, bongo.
Dave Franco.
That's good. It's good to be positive despite making zero progress in a year.
And franchise newbie Lizzie Kaplan, who flirts with Franco by picking his pockets and then his pants.
So then what about girls?
Look, it's not something I'm proud of, but every girl I get close to, I end up taking their trust and then their wallet.
You take their wallets?
She hands him his.
You ever take their belts?
That too.
I'm sorry, did you think that I was like those other girls?
I'm not sure I could spoil the plot if I wanted to, but these pranksters, who call themselves the Horsemen, end up in Macau doing the bidding of another newbie, Daniel Radcliffe. He wants them to swipe a MacGuffin called the Stick.
So, the Stick.
Go to hell.
It sounds like any old fight scene, but they're using mirrors, curtains, and other tricks of the trick trade. The movie is most fun when it thinks of ways for its heroes to elude danger using magic.
It's all in the wrist.
Once upon a time, digital effects meant the dexterity of your fingers if you were talking card tricks. Now it's a way to fudge what actors may not be able to do. This movie's best scene is the horseman smuggling a computer chip out of a secure building. It's the size of a playing card, wouldn't you know? And as they pass it from person to person, it's fun. But the suspicion that that card was drawn in long after the director called cut spoils the fun. Makes you wish the movie's sleight of hand were deft enough to steal your watch, instead of just making you check it. I'm Chris Klimek.
It's been another week in which social media has demonstrated its power to disseminate news. We're learning today how that powerful statement from the 23-year-old sexually assaulted by a former Stanford student went viral. The Boston Globe reports that Stanford law professor Michelle Dauber heard the statement in court, then contacted Amy Ziering, the producer of that campus rape documentary, The Hunting Ground. Amy had a friend at BuzzFeed, so she contacted the victim, got her blessing, and then asked her own daughter if BuzzFeed would be a good way to get the statement out. Her daughter said yes. It went to BuzzFeed and then viral. Meanwhile, Vice President Joe Biden, who introduced the Violence Against Women Act in 1990, wrote an open letter to the victim on BuzzFeed Today. That is trending. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Also this week, there was that tweet from Hillary Clinton. It was retweeted more than 100,000 times within an hour. Kate Somers-Dawes is deputy managing editor at Mashable. She joins us from San Francisco. Kate, tell us about the tweet. What prompted it?
After President Obama endorsed Hillary Clinton as the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, Donald Trump tweeted that Obama just endorsed, quote, crooked Hillary. He wants 4 more years of Obama, but no one else does, exclamation point. And Hillary Clinton's camp responded very quickly. About 5 minutes later on Twitter, she or someone on her staff more likely tweeted the 3 words, delete your account. Which was quickly then trending on Twitter, and within hours, as you said, one of the most popular tweets of her campaign. It's now got almost 400,000 retweets and more than 400,000 likes on Twitter.
So tell us, delete your account.
So delete your account has a sort of a very long and storied history in online communities. According to the site Know Your Meme, which is a very useful tool for me and for your listeners who may be trying to decipher internet speak, delete your account is, quote, an online slang expression commonly used as an insult by calling an individual to voluntarily excommunicate him or herself from an online community.
Yes, delete your account, a real smackdown. So what are people saying? Read some of the things that were then tweeted.
So Hillary Clinton's tweet, delete your account, obviously made big waves very quickly on the social media site. One user, KungFuPanda1, wrote, quote, Hillary did the delete your account meme, so I have to vote for her now. That was sort of a popular sentiment. Another user wrote, Hillary Clinton telling Donald Trump to delete his account on Twitter just probably won her the presidential election. So
really? It's that big in social media land?
It's that big in social media land. I think part of that comes from it's a statement that has a very kind of long history. Know Your Meme gives an example of it as old as 2008. But it also actually has another famous instance, even in just this campaign. When Jeb Bush was running for president, he tweeted an image of a firearm with the word America, period, underneath it. And none other than Edward Snowden quickly responded with 3 words, which were, of course, delete your account. Mm.
Okay, so we know that for the second day of the year, yesterday, Hillary Clinton surpassed Donald Trump in total mentions. And for people saying, oh, gosh, you know, what, this is just social media. It's not. You know, it's where a huge part of the election is playing out. But I would think that she would run a risk if she kind of kept venturing into what some might see as snarky. He is the king of snark. That's what he does. But she certainly can't, you know, try to match him on that.
Sure. I mean, that's a good point, Robin. And I think that's part of why this particular expression that she used was so successful. Because, yes, it's snarky, but it's also funny. It's not serious. It's not an insult in the classic sort of way that Donald Trump has been using sort of personal attacks. She's acknowledging the way that young people speak, the way that people who use Twitter speak. And I think to see someone sort of at that level in their career, someone who's running, you know, running for president as the presumptive nominee, to sort of acknowledge the way the youth sort of use online media, mm-hmm. I think really resonates with them. And it doesn't come across as an insult in the same way that other words might.
It's hip. Okay, you also wanted us to know about a valedictorian at McKinney Boyd High School in Texas, Larissa Martinez. And in her speech, she made a big reveal.
I am one of the 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the shadows of the United States. I decided to stand before you today and reveal these unexpected realities because this might be my only chance to convey the truth to all of you that undocumented immigrants are people too.
Larissa said she and her family came to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 12. She was brought here, and she went on to say she didn't have the internet, a washing machine, or her own bed. Her family had left an abusive father in Mexico. There she is, valedictorian. And by the way, I think going on to Yale. So what's being said online?
Online reaction is sort of split into two camps that kind of interestingly enough mirror the sort of national divide on this issue. There were kind of those who praised her courage for coming out and saying something about herself that is so divisive and on such a grand scale, and then others who kind of immediately came forth and said she should be deported.
Well, and we will stay tuned. Kate Summers-Dawes, Deputy Managing Editor at Mashable, with a look at the week through the social media prism. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Glad to be here.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.